compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Father Matthew Spencer, really happy to be with you today, sitting in for Patrick, who's doing just fine. He was scheduled to be on a cruise this week. That's why I'm here, right? Right, Cyrus? We scheduled this a couple months back, I think.
That's right. Yeah. So unfortunately, that fell through. But then Patrick went and got himself a cold, and his voice has taken a beating. And so it's like, yeah. Patrick, I already have Father Matthew all set. Rest your voice, man. And he's like, all right.
Yeah. You're good. You're good taking care of Patrick.
He does not want to take time off.
He works hard. He really works super hard. Yeah, really it's. I'm always amazed at all the work he's doing here on the radio or evangelizing on the road or even when he goes on a cruise. It's not to relax, really. You know,
it's work.
It's work. Yeah, it's to help people to come to know Jesus better. So, I'm sure he's doing fine. But I'm glad to give him a little bit more R&R myself, which is kind of it's providential because I was already scheduled to be here. So. I want to get to this story about a pastor, but Memo's been waiting for a while. I don't want to keep Memo waiting on the line. So why don't we go back to the phones? If you want to call in, 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Happy to take your questions or to have a conversation with you if you have some question about the faith, about our church, about the world, and how we respond to that. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Memo's calling from Montebello, California. Hello, Memo. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show.
Hi, Father. My question is, we have a two-month-old granddaughter that the father doesn't want baptized. He's a Protestant. And my daughter was saying, well, Dad, you know, you always go to church and you're a real Catholic. Can you baptize her? Because my husband is not going to allow me to baptize her. Now, we have a 7-year-old, Lucas, which we got him baptized. So who can baptize? That's my question.
Okay, this is a good question, but I'm glad that you also share the circumstances with me because that will actually affect my answer for you. So let me give you the kind of the basic understanding. Who can baptize? In fact, anybody can baptize. You don't even need to be baptized yourself to baptize another person. In an emergency, you can baptize. Anybody can baptize another person if they use water and if they use the proper formula and they use the proper action of pouring that water or perhaps immersing the individual in water. So, for example, nurses, although they might not be Catholic, might not even be Christian, are oftentimes trained in how to baptize so that if there is an emergency, if there is a life and death situation, they are able to make sure that that Catholic family will have their loved one baptized. Okay, so that's the simple answer to the basic question of what you're asking. That in fact anybody can baptize, but in this circumstance, I would not recommend you baptizing your grandson, you said, or your granddaughter?
Daughter. Yeah, my granddaughter.
Yeah, I would not recommend it because it's also very important to respect what parents want for their children. And we want baptism for your granddaughter, certainly, without a doubt. But it's not the right way to go about it by subversively doing this to your granddaughter around your son-in-law's wishes, right? There are a variety of reasons.
My daughter just wanted to baptize Grace.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the father doesn't. And he says, we have to wait until, you know, I guess the Protestants wait till they're like 15, 16, and then they decide.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope that through conversation, through dialogue, your son-in-law will change his mind because this is an important thing. We want your granddaughter to be baptized as soon as possible. But we also very much respect the authority that parents have. And it, frankly, it can create even more problems for the marriage, for your own relationship with them, if you try to go around your son-in-law's back. So pray about this, right? Pray for a change of heart in your son-in-law's life, because the best outcome for this is not only your granddaughter being baptized, but your son-in-law also coming into the church, right? Your son-in-law having his own conversion and seeing that, oh wow, baptism is different than how I was taught. Baptism is available to youngsters and to infants even. And that would be the ideal outcome of this, not only that your granddaughter is baptized, but that your son-in-law has a conversion. And I think that's going to take prayer and that's going to take some work. So we really do respect the authority of parents. Encourage your own daughter to keep communicating with her husband, to keep communicating her wishes, not nagging, but trying to communicate what baptism is about, right? Does that make sense?
Okay, we'll keep trying. He's really stubborn on the fact that she's not going to get baptized, period. He told my daughter, we're already baptized, Lucas. You got your one of them, so give me the other one. We're not going to baptize her. But you know what? I'll keep praying for him and for my daughter that we can do this, and hopefully we can at some point.
Yeah, that's interesting that he let one of his children be baptized as an infant, but now he's saying, no, this other one won't be that. That's kind of, that doesn't make a lot of logical sense to me, but okay, there's at least an opening there that you could work on, you know, that maybe it's about, yeah, you know, him wanting to have some spiritual leadership in the family. And maybe that's something you can affirm him on, that maybe, I'm glad that he has an opinion on it. I'm glad that he's not just completely indifferent to it. That's a good starting point, in my opinion. We want him to,
yeah, he's,
you know,
a really good, He's a really good Christian. He goes to his church, and you know, he plays the guitar at the church and everything. But it's just, you know, the Protestants don't believe in child infant baptism. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they've done. But thank you so much, Father. I will definitely start a good rosary prayer.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, and all of our listeners will say a quick prayer for you, for your granddaughter, for your son-in-law and your daughter as well, Memo. I mean, these situations need a lot of prayer, don't they? And they don't change overnight. But in my experience, when we approach them with a real desire for transformation in the hearts of all of those involved, then we will see those results, even if it takes some time. So God bless,
Definitely.
Memo. Thanks
thank
for calling.
Thank you so much.
You bet. All the best.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. I want to share this story with you that I read. On Sunday, there was a pastor of a Christian church, non-Catholic Christian church, who was trying to illustrate a gospel passage. Of course, you know the passage when Jesus mixes his saliva with dirt and rubs it on the blind man's eyes and heals the man of his blindness. It's a rather earthy example, right? I mean, Jesus uses real earthy means. He uses his own saliva. He uses the dirt of the earth, and it might seem a little strange, but of course, Saint Mark in describing that has a lot of purposes, and well, I should say Jesus has a lot of purposes in doing it that way. Well, it was Pastor Mike Todd of Transformation Church in Tulsa who made a splash in the media after his sermon and his demonstration on Sunday. Let me just let ABC8 share exactly what happened.
A local pastor is trending nationwide tonight. Pastor Mike Todd of Transformation Church made some people in the crowd and online uneasy during a demonstration in his sermon. Todd wiped his spit onto the face of his brother, according to TMZ, to show that receiving God's vision can sometimes be nasty. After the move, a gasp from people in attendance could be heard, and some people online curious as to why he'd do it during a pandemic. We reached out to Transformation Church, who says they have no comment at this time.
Where do I go with this, Cyrus? Why did I mention this? No, I do have a point here. No, when I first saw this news story, I saw it with the video, and the video shows him spitting into his hand and rubbing it onto the face of his brother. And
lovely.
It's gross. I mean, can I just, there's mucus falling off his brother's
okay,
face, and
okay.
It's really, what, I mean, I'm just saying, you know, just describing it, not trying to gross people out. Let me, before we get too far along, this pastor did repent of doing this. He did apologize. He made a little video, put it on Twitter, and while the video doesn't necessarily say he's sorry, he certainly did inside the text of the tweet. But let me share a little portion of that video with you now.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I hope you're having an amazing Monday. I just want to acknowledge what happened yesterday when the spit hit the fan. I watched it back, and it was disgusting. Like, that was gross. I want to validate everybody's feelings. That was a distraction to what I was really trying to do. I was really trying to make the word come alive and for people to see the story. But yesterday it got too live, and I own that. And I just want to make sure people know that we want to help people. We want people to see Jesus. We want people to feel loved. We want people who are desperate to be able to find hope.
I think also, so let me just say this, first of all, I think it's great he owned up to it. I think it's great that he came out and said, yeah, that was probably not the best way to do this. That
it
was
got too live.
It got too live. I'm going to start saying that. Yeah. He, you know, what I found myself thinking about, it's not like trying to, you know, disparage this guy and give him a hard time. He's probably already tired of the media attention that this has brought, mostly negative at this point. Besides the health concerns that might be involved with this, what I couldn't help but think about, Cyrus, is how many times I've seen at Mass priests try and use gimmicks. You know, whether we're talking about doing magic tricks during their homily, maybe they
what?
Plan with somebody to. You've never seen that?
I have not seen that. No.
Oh. Yeah, no, I've seen that. I've seen that more than once. People who, priests who, you know, use their gift of magic and will then do some trick and try to illustrate the gospel. But it's a reach, right? It's a stretch, at least in the circumstances I've seen. We've all seen videos online of people moving forward in the procession on their hoverboards, right? Their two-wheeled scooters that... Especially when priests do that, it just blows my mind. Like, what are you doing? I know that priests have this desire, and I'm not here to like criticize or to try and just be mean to other priests out there. Mostly it's just an observation that, you know, priests, me included, we want to communicate the gospel, and we want that gospel message to be memorable for you. I don't think that's the right way to do it, using spit. I don't think that's the right way to do it, using magic tricks, using hoverboards, using cell phones to set up a call beforehand that interrupts your homily somehow. All these gimmicks I've seen used. Just give me the plain gospel message. Just give me a good homily and exposition of the gospel, and I'm content. I don't know about you. Are you? Do these gimmicks help you?
Do you think the priest is trying to, placate the masses by entertain? Because people want to be entertained all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is boring. Make it more fun. Entertain me.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the problem. Is that priests have fallen into the trap of thinking that people need to be entertained to feel that Mass was worth it. I think that priests want their people to go away. I don't want to try and read into the intent of priests who might pick up a guitar at the homily and sing a song and try and use something to grab the attention of the, maybe it's not to entertain them. Maybe they really believe that this will communicate the gospel message better than their own words. I don't really know. But I do think it's part of our culture that has arisen, where we think that we need to do something more dramatic than last time. We think we need to do something more that attracts more attention than last time. And I think we're always trying to one-up ourselves rather than say, wait, this is the gospel message. This is Jesus. Every time we open up the scriptures and every time we look at what Jesus teaches us, there is something valuable and special that we can learn here. So I don't know. I think I'm going to let this guy off the hook. I don't want to bash him. Certainly, I think he recognized probably pretty quickly that he had crossed the line. And I've never gone viral, thanks be to God. But I have to say I've done silly things in my life, and I'd really cringe if they went viral like this one did. So you know. I think I'm just saying on behalf of most people, and maybe I don't represent everybody, can I just ask priests to just stick to the gospel? You know, can we just stick to the basics? And I don't think we need gimmicks in our homilies. I don't think we need to be entertained. I think we can walk away from Mass completely nourished, even when the priest might not be so entertaining, right? And I think that's an important part of our Catholic theology. So let me look to the phones here. Let's go to John, who's calling from Philadelphia and who's been waiting for a little while. Hello, John. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show.
Yes, Father. Thanks very much. Question. It seems to be the abortion issue is kind of like I'm personally opposed to gas ovens, and I'm personally opposed to guillotines and let's see, gas chambers. I keep electing people who want to donate money to their cause, okay, so that they can, you know, be successful. And I'm thinking, gee, the end is so terrible. It's like, how can you support that? You know, it's like I'm personally opposed to people, you know, beating their dogs or their children or, heaven forbid, their wives. But I'm going to elect them anyhow because they're good dancers, you know. That's terrible.
Yeah, I'm with you, John. It's strange the world we live in. The what people in their minds will justify, right? And they'll, especially, I think this as you point out, we make this distinction in our mind somehow. Well, I'm personally opposed to this, but how could I impose that view on other people? I just look at that and think that's totally nonsensical. If I believe that treating people right is a value, then I am going to do everything I can to help others do that same thing. I'm not going to separate them and say, well, you don't have to treat them because maybe you don't believe that that's the case. It's just logically, it doesn't make sense to me, John.
Yeah.
But this is the world we live in, right? So I think we have to do our...
I'm sad to say, Father, but... You know, but again, communicating is important. I think we have to let people know that it's not okay, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, John. Thanks. That's a good observation, and I think one that a lot of people don't really think through and really need to do that, especially before voting. Appreciate the observation, John. God bless you and all the best to you. We're going to take a quick time out now, but I'm hoping when we return that Mark and Sharon can stay on the line. You've been waiting for a little while, and I'll get to you right after the break. And also, if you want to call in, 888-914-9149 is the number to call. I'd be happy to take your question here on the Patrick Madrid Show. I'm Father Matthew Spencer. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. I'm Father Matthew Spencer. Really, really blessed to be sitting in for Patrick for the next day or two. And I hope that you'll join the conversation. We have Sharon, who's been waiting for a little while. She's calling from San Diego. Hello, Sharon. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show.
Good morning, Father. I have to go into work real quick. So if I can't hear your answer, then I'll just replay the...
Oh, okay, great. Go ahead.
My two-part question. I've been starting to say the rosary quite often for many, many different intentions. And I've also been part of a prayer group. I was always told, or I read, prayer groups are more for something national, like you pray for, you know, for pro-life, or you pray for peace on earth or something. When you're praying, two-part question. When you're praying in the group prayer, can you make a special intention for yourself? Mm. Not for yourself, but for someone like your child or something personal to you? Or is it more meaningful if it's a more of a national prayer?
Oh, very good question, Sharon. So don't let me make you late for work. If you need to run in, no
it's
problem.
Okay. I've been dying to ask you this a couple times on how to hang up. So I've been really curious. I've been loving to say the prayer, the rosary, and I just want to make sure my intentions are I'm doing it the right way for my special intentions.
Excellent. Yeah. So the rosary is a wonderful prayer because it can be done personally, privately, and it can also be done in community or with other people. It can be done with just a few other people. It can be done with a family, or it can be done in a whole church community. That's to me, one of the things I love about the rosary is it's rather flexible that way. And when we're praying it in a group, there certainly can be an overall purpose or intention. For example, a lot of churches will pray the rosary for the end to abortion, and that will be a very important intention of the whole group that is prayed for. But for each person, you also have the possibility of presenting to the Lord your own needs. It's not like a prayer has a certain limited amount of grace that, well, I can only present one petition for this, right? And that's especially true at the rosary, I think, because when
that's
we connect...
That's what I wasn't sure of. I know it sounds funny, but I wasn't sure. I know that sounds funny, but I wasn't sure if you're only allowed like certain special intentions. And if you do an overall intention and then you end up doing some special ones when you go through certain mysteries, is that... just as special, or the intent is still very good?
It's very much allowed. It's very much, I would say it's very much encouraged. You don't need to limit your prayer intentions to just one thing, as if then it will be more powerful or more concentrated that way. I think, especially when we think of prayer, it's important to not reduce it to some kind of currency or exchange, as if, well, I'm only going to get a certain amount for this prayer, right? Because God in his abundant mercy wants us to profit from our prayers and wants to multiply his grace for us. So certainly don't be afraid to add your own intentions, to include your own needs, to pray for the people in your life, even if you're praying with other people, and even if there are other overarching intentions that are shared, certainly bring your own personal intentions as well, okay? Because that will be important. Yeah. And
okay,
I would
thank
say
you very much.
Yeah, you bet. God bless you, Sharon. All the best to you. Thanks for calling in.
You could talk more. I'll listen later. But
yeah, very good.
So
I think
much.
I will. Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Sharon. God bless you. I think I will continue this, even though Sharon has to race off to work. God bless her. What also comes to my mind, she mentioned prayer groups, and this is important too. Prayer groups can have as she mentioned, a national focus, or maybe a very particular spiritual focus to them. But prayer groups are a rather dynamic or organic way that we as human beings can gather and pray together, and they're very helpful. They can be done for personal needs that we then bring to the group. They can be done for a larger movement across the country or across the church. So prayer groups, I think, are a supplement to our spiritual life that aid us that way. And maybe you need some support in your own prayer life. I think prayer groups provide an avenue to deepen our prayer in maybe ways that personal prayer can't always offer. Don't get me wrong. Personal prayer is kind of the core and the an essential part of your own walk with Jesus. But just as the Mass has to be the heart of your spiritual life, just as the Eucharist has to be the source and summit of your connection to God and to our faith, so also those times when we come together with other Christian believers can aid us in that commitment. So prayer groups can be very helpful. Now, they need to be organized well. They need to have good theological foundations to them. They need to have good leadership to them as well. But those can be helpful. Maybe I say that because Sharon mentioned it anyway, and I think for many of us, we might have a pretty regular, consistent prayer life where we're praying the rosary on our own, maybe. Maybe we're praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet with Drew every day. But maybe we need the support of other Christians as well. And maybe in your local parish, there might be an opportunity to do that and to pray, to broaden your prayer life, which can always be helpful. Very good. Why don't we go to Mark, who is calling from, I don't want to mispronounce this, Mark, from Wisconsin, Menomonee Falls. Did I get that right, Mark?
Yes, Menomonee Falls.
Menomonee. Ah, very good. Beautiful. Yes. What's on your mind, Mark? Thanks for calling in.
My question is about Holy Communion. Years ago, I would see my dad when I was 8, 9, 10, so it was about 40 years ago. So I would see my dad stay back from communion. We were at church. I know he was Catholic born, all that kind of stuff and Catholic. But I would see him stay back from communion. So first question is, what are the reasons someone would be considered not worthy of receiving communion or consider themselves not worthy of receiving communion? The second part is, I bring my mother to church, and I have to worry about her standing up and falling while she's sitting. So I myself have stayed back from communion just to make sure she doesn't stand up and fall, so on and so forth. Am I committing sin by not going up for communion, even though, you know, I'm worthy of it? So if you don't mind, I would love to hear these reasons, and I will just go ahead and hang up and listen on the radio. I know you've got other callers.
All right, fantastic. Thanks, Mark, for calling in. I'll be really happy to field these questions. God bless you. Let's talk about what Mark presents are actually two different questions in the first part of his first question. He says, on the one hand, what would prevent somebody from going to Holy Communion? What would make it so they shouldn't go to Holy Communion? That's one question. The other question is, why would a person consider themselves not worthy to go to Holy Communion? And in fact, that's a very different thing. That people will answer that much more differently. Let me explain. There are very objective reasons why somebody shouldn't go to Holy Communion. First of all, if you're not Catholic, then you shouldn't go to Holy Communion, right? If you're not baptized, you can't receive Holy Communion because you have to be baptized in order to enter into the sacramental life. There are very clear objective reasons why one might not go to communion, including for Catholics. If a Catholic is in the state of mortal sin, then they should not approach and present themselves for Holy Communion. That is, if they're living a life that's not consistent with the life of the Church, maybe they're living a sexual relationship outside of marriage, maybe they have fallen into grave sin, which can happen in a whole variety of different ways, and therefore they shouldn't go to Holy Communion. But the question about why a person might consider themselves unworthy to go to communion is a little bit different, because it really depends on how that person's conscience was formed and how that person sees their relationship with God. Let me give you an example, an illustration from my own experience working as a priest. I grew up in a family. I was born in California, and in my family, we always went to church, and receiving communion was what practically everybody did in all the churches I went to. It never was a common thing that I saw that people would largely refrain from receiving communion. And then I became a priest, and I started working in some Latino parishes in California with largely immigrant communities. And I was surprised how many of those people would not approach Holy Communion. And at first I thought it was because, as I mentioned a moment ago, maybe because of objective reasons. Maybe they weren't living their lives according to the teachings of the Church. Maybe they had fallen into mortal sin and hadn't had an opportunity to go to confession. But I soon realized after some weeks and months that in fact their own conscience and perspective on receiving communion was formed very differently, either in Mexico or in other Central or South American countries. They were taught that they should not receive communion unless they went to confession a few days before that period. Whether they had committed a mortal sin or not, That is to say, their consciences were formed in a very sensitive way, perhaps even providing them more strict, I shouldn't say perhaps, oftentimes providing them more strict criteria than even the church would do. And so many people wouldn't approach communion because of a reverence for the Eucharist, because of the formation that they received. So as Mark called a few moments ago, and he says, and he asks about why did his father not go to communion regularly, it's hard to say. And in fact, I don't think it is our place to try and discern that. Can we look into his heart and see if there were sins there? Do we know how his conscience was formed? No. What I would say is this is a very personal decision that everybody must make. And I think when people have a reverence for the Eucharist, they will approach with more trepidation. They will be a little more careful about approaching the communion unworthily. I certainly don't want people to become Jansenists or to become scrupulous, that is to say, to imagine that they can't receive communion because of only venial sins or maybe because of a hyper sensitive conscience. That's not healthy either. But on the other hand, sometimes I think that we aren't as aware of our sins or of our worthiness to go to communion as we should be. And so, Mark, maybe your father was either struggling with this, or maybe he was just aware that there was a worthiness issue that he hadn't been able to resolve yet. I wouldn't worry about it so much, or even try to figure it out, because that's kind of between him and God. And I think there are legitimate reasons why we won't approach communion, and some of those go back to our formation. Some of those have to do with our own personal decisions and sins. Some of those also, frankly, have to do with practical things. You might see somebody not go to communion, and your mind might immediately jump to think, "Oh, did they commit a sin?" When perhaps they ate without time for the Eucharistic fast, and for one reason or the other, they did that, and now they can't go to communion, and it's not necessarily out of sin, but because of their own awareness that they need to observe the Eucharistic fast, and so they don't go to communion that way. So lots of different reasons why. The second question that Mark asked is now escaping my mind. Cyrus, do you recall what the second part of Mark's question, as I've been pontificating here over and over again?
Sorry, Mark.
Oh, I remember now. Oh, thanks. That's all I needed, Cyrus, is just that apology.
Yeah, I'm a big help.
He was talking about his mother and caring for his mother and not being able to go up for communion. And is that a sin if you're at Mass and or is there a problem with that and you don't go for communion yourself? There is no obligation to go to Holy Communion when you go to Mass. The one Easter obligation we have is to receive communion at least once a year, to go to confession once a year if we have sin on our conscience. But ultimately, you're not obliged to go to communion each time you go to Mass. Now, that's the ideal. Hopefully, you can each time you go to Holy Mass receive Holy Communion. And in Mark's case, I would say I hope that there could be accommodations made. Most churches, when people have a hard time maybe getting out of the pew or being able to move forward, we can bring communion to you. And Mark, maybe that's something you need to talk to your pastor about, or maybe it's a matter of being seated in the front where it's a little easier to bring communion to you and to your mother, and therefore to be able to receive. But no, it's not a problem if you don't go to communion because of the practical circumstances there. But I would certainly hope that if you're able to receive communion, that you would, because that's certainly the pinnacle of our participation in the Holy Eucharist, is being able to receive the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So very interesting. Good questions. I'm grateful that you called, Mark. We're going to take a quick time out. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. It's Father Matthew Spencer sitting in for Patrick. If you want to call, we have a few lines open, 888-914-9149, and when we get back, we'll return to the phones.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. It's Father Matthew Spencer. Blessed to be with you this morning, sitting in for Patrick, who's just getting to relax a little bit today and tomorrow. Don't forget, coming up this Friday and Saturday, we have the March for Life, the Walk for Life. We have the whole movement of life, which really gets energized right around the tragic anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which I hope soon will topple. Here at Relevant Radio, in solidarity with the March for Life, we have our annual Fast for Life campaign, which is coming up this Friday. Tell us how you plan to pray and sacrifice for the unborn. You can go to relevantradio.com/fast. This year, Relevant Radio and Solidarity HealthShare are proud to offer our Fast for Life participants a free bonus ebook. And you can download it when you sign up. It's entitled The Choice is Love. And this ebook will answer a variety of questions, such as if a woman is pregnant and decides to have an abortion, shouldn't that be her right since it is her body? Maybe you've wondered how to answer these questions, how to enter into dialogue with others. Well, all you have to do, get this free ebook, is sign up. Go to relevantradio.com/fast. I think even more important than getting the ebook, though, is when you're fasting, your sacrifices are united to those of other Christians around the world and around our country. They become that much more powerful, that much more effective. So make sure and go to relevantradio.com/fast and get your free download of The Choice is Love and join us in working to end the scourge of abortion in our country and in the world. Right back to the phones. I believe we have Tracy, who's calling from Newbern, North Carolina. Hello, Tracy. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. I think, there we go. Tracy,
Hi,
how are you? Hi.
Good. I have a question regarding this author that my young teenage son is reading, Rick Riordan. And I believe he did the Percy Jackson series. This is sort of the sequel to that. It's called The Red Pyramid. And the content in it goes, talks about the gods of ancient Egypt. You know, it's a story about two siblings who are trying to save their dad with this, the gods of ancient Egypt trying to, you know, cause him harm. As Catholics, are we allowed to read things like this? Is there a website that I can check different books and see what, you know, the Catholic Church says about them? I'm just...
Wow,
I'm not
that's
sure. I don't feel like it's a good choice, and I'm getting a lot of pushback. So,
yeah, I think back to my teenage years, Tracy, when I couldn't be bothered what my parents' opinion was about what I was reading. In fact, if I was bothered by it, I would only read them all the more. Right? I felt like I was it was kind of this interest in my life, and I guess I wasn't reading terrible things, but certainly my parents were having to navigate, as you're doing, having to navigate a whole variety of sources and books out there that are fantasy, maybe that are maybe have content that might be objectionable, but on the other hand, do they have overall a message that is affirming and consistent with the gospel? So let me say this first of all, Tracy. I'm not familiar with the author you mentioned. I'm not familiar with the books he's written, and I'm not familiar, unfortunately, with a service that will review books from a Catholic perspective, which is interesting. We've had, of course, as a church, we've had movie reviewers, we've had reviews of maybe adult books, you know, that will Catholic sites will review for, or adults meant for books meant for adults is what I mean to say, and that will help us to understand better how valuable these books or these resources are. But when it comes to books for children or for teens, I'm not familiar with it. I'm gonna look around though later today and see if there are resources that way. Here's my take on it, though, is I believe that parents should know what their kids are reading. You know, I believe that the parents should be able to read and not necessarily just say, oh, you can't read that. that's not good for you. But to read it and say, well, this is why. These are the problematic things. These are the themes that I found difficult to reconcile with you. I think it's very hard, though, to convince teens that they shouldn't read something because, well, they're reading it because it interests them, or maybe their friends are reading it, or something like that. And maybe more than trying to, wrestle them to read something else is to engage in a dialogue with them and read it yourself and say, is this okay? Is this going to help them? And it might not be a perfect book that they're reading, but on the other hand, maybe the dialogue itself that you can open up with them will be more helpful than if they read kind of a vanilla book that didn't have any problematic things at all. Okay. I think steering them towards books that have overarching good themes. I'm thinking of The Lord of the Rings, which is such a fantastic epic trilogy of books, including the Hobbit, that is to say, that was written by a Catholic, and J.R.R. Tolkien, of course, was very clear that he wasn't trying to insert Catholic theology within his books, but it just comes out, right? It shines forth from that. And so that's just important. Oh, thank you for that theme.
Just a little background music.
I feel like I'm in the Shire, right?
And what a nice feeling that is.
Yeah. That's what I'd say, Tracy. I'm really glad that you're asking these questions. And I think talking with our teenagers about what is good for them and maybe what is not good for them is important. As I've mentioned here on this program before, we only have a little bit of time in life. We can't read everything. And I think it's important to communicate to our children as well that if you pick one thing to read, you're saying no to 1,000 other things. And so pick the best you can. Don't just pick what everybody else is reading. Don't just pick what immediately is interesting to you at the moment, but think deeply about, is this going to be helpful for you? Whether teenagers are ready to do that or not, I don't know. We have to help them in that, and maybe they won't be so focused on that. But I think with your conversations with them, it can open up a dialogue that can help steer them in the right direction.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, God bless you. Yeah, all the best to you, Tracy. I have to say, Cyrus, it must be so hard to be a parent these days. It must be so hard to be a grandparent these days. I mean, the amount of influences that our young people have on them is just overwhelming. And how to help filter out the bad things, how to encourage the good things, and yet how to also cooperate with the free will of those who are, of our children. Well, this is a very difficult, subtle.
Yeah, Tracy's already in the winner's circle just by having her children read. It's an ongoing battle.
That's a very good point.
In my house.
That's a very good point.
I can't get them to read any. There's so many screens to look at.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. And maybe I don't know, again, she mentioned a few books and one author in particular, and I'm really hesitant to say anything about it because I don't want to say something negative if the author's good. I don't want to also encourage people to read it. But on the other hand, I do think that we're hard-pressed these days to find perfect reading material. And I think when a parent is able to understand what their children are reading, it makes a big difference because they'll clearly know what moral things might arise, what questions about faith might be there, and also be able to share maybe some insights with their children that, well, they might talk about magic here, for example, but let's talk about grace and how grace is even deeper than magic and kind of work those elements of our faith in there. So.
Yeah, and The Lord of the Rings has all of it.
It does.
So
it has.
Encourage your kids to read The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and on top of all that, it has amazing English. I mean, the literature, the literary value of those works, to me, it just exceeds so much of the drivel that's written these days.
Amen.
yeah. Okay, why don't we go to Ray, who's calling from Lakewood, California. Hello, Ray. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show.
Yes, I have a question, and that is that My wife lost her mother in 2007, and it was here in our home. She expired in our home. And ever since then, she's been in deep depression. And in fact, now, you know, I find her just looking at old photos of her mom, family photos of herself, her siblings, her father, who's also gone. And now, you know, she's just lost any fervor for life. She doesn't go to Mass anymore and hasn't for many years. And I'm afraid that I also found myself lying to our friends about what was going on with her, not knowing what to say when they'd inquire. And I've lost my companionship. You know, here I am. We're married over 50 years. And she's been gone since 2007. And it's very difficult, not just for me, but for my children who want their mom back. And as of lately, you know, she'll just out of nowhere remind me of the birthday of someone who's been deceased for years. You know, that's something that's been going on for, I'd say, last 3 years, just out of the blue. And I'm beyond worried. I just don't know what to do.
Yeah, it sounds like she needs some help, some professional help, right? I mean, sounds to me, and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but it sounds to me like she's overwhelmed with grief, and maybe that grief has now morphed into depression, has morphed into to this just indifference for living, or maybe apathy for the zeal of life. And that's no way to live. And certainly besides your own happiness and the happiness of your children, we're concerned about the happiness of your wife herself, right? I mean, this is no way to live. And I think she needs help getting out of this spiral, Ray. And I don't know what kind of things you've tried. Have you been able to help her to see a professional to talk through these things? Is she willing to kind of look at things differently?
Yes, we did. But, you know, I'm a Vietnam Marine, and I went through PTSD, and I know that the only way you can work through things is to go, you know, get help and then participate. You know, I went through psychotherapy and in group therapy, and that's what works. It works when you participate. My wife did, but she didn't participate. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
she just went for the appointments that were required of her, and then that was it.
How long was that? How many appointments was it?
I'd say she did about 6 months of it, maybe one a week.
And this was back in 2007?
Oh, no, that was as of like 2010, 2011, when we finally convinced her to, you know, that help was needed, you know.
Yeah. It's, you know, Ray, Cyrus and I were talking after that tragic story that we talked about earlier in the program today, this mentally ill man who pushed a young lady in front of a subway over the weekend, just terrible. And it happened largely, apparently, because he struggles from deep, severe mental illness. And Cyrus and I were talking about how this problem has become even more exasperated, even more acute since the pandemic hit. I mean, people have been isolated, people have been alone, people have been seeing darkness in the world and have lost hope that way. And I wouldn't be surprised if this has contributed even more to your wife sinking down deeper. My encouragement to you is, you're right, first of all. I mean, if somebody is going to be helped, they need to want it, right? They need to participate. But that willingness sometimes follows a stronger intervention of sorts. That is to say, eventually for somebody to get well, they need to realize that they need the help. But sometimes for them to realize they need the help, they need some help from others to make sure that they realize this is not okay the way you're living. And before they've become convinced that they need the help, they need others to impress this upon them. I think you and your children expressing this to your wife is important. I'm sure you've tried to do this, but after so many years, it can become almost almost just the way that you interact. This is how she is, and she feels like there's no escape from it. And I think you communicating to her, this is not okay. I think you're going to Mass, thanks be to God. If your wife isn't, that's something certainly to bring to the Lord. And maybe that's where you start. Maybe you say, look, you need this. This is important, and it's important that you now step up to do this. That will be a huge help for her, even if she doesn't see the benefits of that right away. But I think that the sacraments will make a big difference in her own perspective. But what it sounds like we're dealing with, Ray, again, not being a psychologist myself, it sounds to me like she's experiencing some deep emotional illness here. And I think to help her means you accompany her, you challenge her, you take some steps that maybe you haven't taken before in order for her to better be able to fight this with your support. Thanks, Ray. We'll pray for you. So will all of the listeners here. God bless you. Thanks for calling in. You're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I'm Father Matthew Spencer. I'll be back right after this. La 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 la